Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, January 23rd. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today, and we welcome back our friend Dr. Valerie Rapson. If you have a question about Mars or comets or gravity, we are ready to talk to you. Give us a call at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. VoxPop@WAMC.org is the email address, and the number, once again, is 800-348-2551. So if something is bugging you up in the heavens, this is your chance. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here. It's Astronomy. We'll get it underway right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We are talking astronomy today, and we welcome back Dr. Valerie Rapson, Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her Ph.D. in Astrophysical Science and Technology at RIT. If you have a question, give us a shout, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email, or 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson, welcome back, and how are you?
Thanks. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. School started yet?
Yes, school started yesterday.
Oh, yeah? How was it?
It was really good. I've got just introductory level classes this semester, so it's a little chill for me, but I'm excited because I have my big astronomy class, and everyone's like really excited. I asked them on the first day, like I always do, you know, what topics do you want to cover? And of course, I get aliens and black holes.
Okay,
right?
So
that's what we're covering, apparently.
Do you have to gently, first of all, do you read the room automatically and say, okay, I got some bright kids here, or these kids are not interested?
I mean, I hope that they're all interested because they choose to take this class. But I try and get a sense of, like, you know, where's everybody at? Like, why are you here? Do you want to learn about science? Are you here because you have to take the class? And then we kind of, you know, adjust things accordingly.
You know, I was saying, do you have to give them a little gentle talking to and say, you know, aliens not necessarily here what we're here for?
Well, you know, I mean, I love talking about aliens.
Right.
So I always tell them that, you know, we're going to cover the more practical side of things. Like, this is not a UFO conspiracy type of class, but we will talk about, you know, other planets and moons where there might be life and the possibility. And I want them to think, like, more practically about it. Like,
yeah.
Just don't believe every article or every video that they see, but what little bit of science can I teach them to help them think more critically about what they're hearing online?
When do you think critical thinking kicks in? At what age for most kids?
I don't know. I think it's different for everybody. You know, some of our best critical thinkers, they go on to become scientists, and I feel like that hits them a little bit younger. Others, they need a little bit more guidance. But a lot of my students, you know, whatever they're most interested in, that's where the highest level of critical thinking comes in, because they care and they want to think more deeply about it.
Oh, so that's a great point.
That's what we see.
Yeah, you sent a couple of great articles, and one of these is one of my favorite things that happens,
mm-hmm.
and it happens fairly often. This is, I believe, from, I don't know, this is from AccuWeather, you sent this link.
Yeah.
Six planets aligning in the night sky will get even better next month. So what planets are we talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, everybody's been talking about the planetary alignment, the planetary parade, and this happens all the time.
Yeah.
But basically, we've got almost all the planets, I think all of them except for Mercury. So we've got Mars, Jupiter, Venus, Saturn, and technically Uranus and Neptune are there as well, although they're generally too faint to see with your eyes, and unless you're in a really dark area and you have to know exactly what you're looking at, because it's just going to look like a teeny little faint dot.
But you can actually see it with your naked eye?
Mm-hmm.
I did
yep.
not know that.
Yeah, they're right on the border, and it depends, you know, exactly how close they are to Earth, and it might change a little bit based on your vision. But yeah, and if you've got a pair of binoculars, it becomes pretty easy to spot them, and they will look kind of greenish blue. So if you get them, you'll know that the object is a little bit different than the star.
That is so amazing. Now, if we looked at, you know, one of these things I always have problems with astronomical photographs is what's real color and what is false color.
Mm-hmm.
But if we were to look at Uranus or Neptune, would we see those hues?
Some of them, yeah. And one of the things, and I just taught this in my class last semester, because they just reprocessed some data from the Voyager spacecrafts, I think it was of Uranus. And, you know, when we think of Uranus and Neptune, Neptune is always depicted as like a dark blue, and Uranus is more like a seafoam green kind of color. But Uranus is actually a lot darker blue than we thought. But it just has to do with, you know, how the camera took the picture, how the filter works, and then how we process the data with the computer afterwards. So recently they tried to do some more like real color imaging.
Yeah.
And it turns out those two planets are much more similar in color than we originally thought. So even in our classic knowledge of what color the planets are, it's all based on the pictures we've seen since we were children.
Right. Another great article you sent was the webtelescope.org, which is one of the coolest websites.
Mm-hmm.
You could see so many amazing things.
All the James Webb stuff is up there, you know, all the big news stories. I love it.
And newfound galaxy class may indicate early black hole growth.
Mm-hmm.
And that is according to the Webb telescope. So tell us about this.
So we've got these new galaxies. They're just little red dots. Literally, that's what they look like, and that's what we're calling them. But basically, these are galaxies that have really high redshift. So they're from the early universe. We're talking like 600 million years after the Big Bang. So really early universe. And all we see is a very bright, brighter than we would have expected, concentrated red dot.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're thinking these must be is essentially black holes that are pulling in material, gathering it in, and growing larger. And they were actually able to take some spectra of these to get the redshift, but they also were able to see that the gases, the material, is moving at like 2 million miles per hour or something crazy.
Wow.
So it's swirling around the center. And we're so excited about it because one of the big questions in astronomy is how did early black holes form, and in particular, how did the supermassive black holes form at the center of galaxies? And to answer that question, we have to look back in time and find the earliest black holes, and these appear to be it. These appear to be kind of some of the primordial black holes that may have grown at that time and kind of kickstarted the black holes that we see today.
Which came first, the black hole or the galaxies?
Well, we think stars formed before anything else,
and then
the stars kind of collected together to form galaxies. But when the actual black holes form and whether or not they played a distinct role in initiating the collection of a galaxy, or did the stars find themselves and then a black hole ended up in the middle, that's still a big open question. These appear to be, and we can't see the individual stars or anything, but these appear to be more concentrations of gas around a black hole. We're not sure how much, if any, the stars are actually there at the moment.
I mean, given time, and what I know about gravity is way, way less than what most people know. But given time, if there's a black hole,
mm-hmm.
will it not coalesce all sorts of material and that's how we form galaxies
I mean, it depends on how everything is moving. So, you know, the common misconception is that black holes are like vacuums. They're just pulling everything straight in from all directions. And that's not really true. They have a gravitational force that emanates outward. So it does have like a pulling and a holding type of force. But pretty much everything in outer space is moving. It's moving in a circular path around these black holes. And as long as you're moving in a circular path at the right speed, you can stay orbiting the black hole forever. So the black hole isn't going to consume everything that is feeling its gravitational force, only the material that is falling towards it for one reason or another. So they will grow in size and they will pull in material that's very close. But if you think about the Milky Way, you know, the Earth is plenty far away from the center that unless something comes and disrupts our orbit, we're never going to fall in. We're never going to get consumed by our supermassive black hole.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest today. It's Astronomy on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number if you have a question. And we'll just chat a little bit here. And then in a couple minutes, we will get to the phones. 800-348-2551. One thing that I didn't send you, and you didn't send me, but I saw it late.
Sure.
This wonderful panoramic, and I forget whether it was the Hubble or the Webb, or this beautiful panoramic picture of the Andromeda Galaxy.
Yes.
Did you see that?
I did see
wow.
that. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was a Hubble image because we haven't had the time with James Webb to like piece all of it together.
I think it was 6,000 images or something
yeah,
they put together.
Yeah, it was crazy because if you think about it, you know, Andromeda is relatively large. It's like a degree. It's like two full moons wide on the sky, technically. And Hubble, when it takes one picture, that's far smaller than the width of a full moon. So we have to take thousands of pictures and stitch them together to be able to see just this galaxy. And that allows us to really zoom in and see all the stars individually. I think they counted, you know, trillions of stars.
They said it was akin to resolving individual particles of sand mm-hmm. on a beach.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing.
It's nuts. It's like, our telescopes are really amazing. And that just goes to show you that, you know, we talk about James Webb being this new thing, and it is amazing. But Hubble is still doing amazing things out there, too.
It's beyond its predicted lifetime, though,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
Yeah, I was actually, so this is the 35th anniversary this year of launch, so I'm doing a public talk in April about this. So I was looking back, and, you know, some of the slides that I had from years ago had the original deorbit date of 2025,
yeah.
because that's when we thought that we could guarantee that all the equipment would still work. And everything is still very functional. So I think they're predicting now, you know, at least 2030, hopefully.
That's
you know,
amazing.
But it depends on funding and anything could break at any moment. So knock on wood. I'm not jinxing anything.
Right.
But hopefully Hubble will survive.
Well,
up
hopefully
there.
It'll stay in the air until your public chat on it.
Yeah, right. Please don't fall yet.
Dr. Valerie Rapson's our guest. It's astronomy, 800-348-2551. 1 minute before the break here, and then we will go to the emails and the phones. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. The last thing you sent me, and this is from Sky and Telescope, NASA's new plans for returning samples from Mars.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we've heard a lot about going to Mars in the last week. It's a Musk thing. He wants to do it. Trump is on board.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what this article's about.
Yeah, so the Perseverance rover, which is already on Mars, it's been driving around and taking samples of both the atmosphere and the soil and some rocks, and it's been leaving it in little test tubes on the ground. And the plan all along has been to send some sort of retrieval vehicle to get them, launch it back off the surface, and bring it back to Earth so we can study some real Martian samples.
Yeah.
It's been the plan all along, but we haven't had, you know, full funding or full commitments to do it. So we're at the point where we either, you know, we have to make a decision, right? Are we going to do this? Are we not? How is the plan going to go? So they're reviewing budgets, and it's a little more expensive than they wanted. It always is, yeah. But long story short, NASA needs to decide in the next year or so how they're going to do this. Are we going to do it publicly, privately? Who's building the rocket to get it back? How are we going to launch it back home? And when is this all going to happen?
Maybe we'll talk a little more about Mars
sure.
in a bit, but let's take a break here and then we'll go to the email bag. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number if you want to talk to Dr. Valerie Rapson about astronomy. We'll check the email bag in a moment. That's Luna Dance from Art Bernstein and Chuck DeLoya, locals here who make amazing music. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Vox Pop Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson, and the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And we'll start with an email from Michael from Benson. What are the rules for space junk? If I had the capital and the means, can I release whatever I wish into the void, say my couch with a dressed mannequin, for example? And that's from Michael.
Yeah. So my basic understanding of the policies is, you know, we're far more concerned about the material that's going to be in Earth's orbit as opposed to stuff that we're launching outside the solar system. For a lot of things, like if you're going to put a satellite up of any kind, there has to be an end of life, a deorbit plan. Either we bring it back to Earth and destroy it, or we can push it up into what they call a graveyard orbit. I forget how many miles high, but it doesn't conflict with the geocentric or geosynchronous orbits or anything like that. And it's kind of a stable spot to place satellites for a long time so that they don't bother us. Sending things out into the solar system is different. If we're going to land on another planet, they have to be fully sanitized, but we don't necessarily have to have a plan to get it back. So it depends on, you know, what you're looking to do.
Interesting. Now, you know, you talked about, we'll get to the phones in just a second. Willie in Schenectady, you'll be first. But you talked about this plan to bring back Mars samples.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Paranoid here, my first concern is that going to be safe? How do we know it will be safe?
Well, I don't think we know. And that's the cool part about it. When the samples come back, if they do, you know, they will be in a sterilized, contained lab just until we know that they're, you know, safe to handle in a little less of an environment there. But we do want to make sure that we don't contaminate anything with Earth as well, because if we're searching for evidence of life on Mars, you know, we want anything that we're testing in the lab to truly be from Mars. Any little bit of air from Earth, any germs, anything contaminating that soil might make us think that there are microbes on a planet when there really aren't.
And that concerns me about the plans to drill into some of these moons that have oceans underneath the ice.
Mm-hmm.
And they've talked about it. I assume it would be extremely expensive to do this, but it's on the table for the distant future.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, isn't that also possible? Maybe there's life down there.
Right.
Maybe we kill it all in one shot.
Mm-hmm. Contamination is a real issue. And, you know, I know we've talked recently on the show about like that strep throat virus that we found on the thing we sent to the moon.
Yeah.
You know, obviously that was unintentional. We thought we sterilized it properly, but clearly we didn't. So we want to be extra careful. So we have to think about not only the science we want to learn, but the ethics behind all of this as well.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest today. It's astronomy. Tell you what, we have a lot of email here, but let's go to the phones. Willie's in Schenectady, 800-348-2551. Willie, you're up.
I want to hold my question to verify that the doctor has read the latest article that talks about an alternative to dark energy.
I don't know if I have, but go ahead and ask your question, and I will do my best to answer.
No, I won't ask the question. I'll call back another time. You need to read this before you can
tell
answer
us what
a question.
Can you tell us what the article name is?
Well, the article says that a better explanation is some voids in space that's causing the acceleration of the planets and things, as opposed to dark energy.
We've talked about this sort of thing before, and I always, you know, they don't know what dark energy is, but here it is, and it explains all our math, and it seems to me that there may be other solutions to this.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely the possibility that our math is wrong, and I think there have been some observations where, you know, what we see, we are attributing to dark energy, but maybe there are these overly expanded blank voids that are kind of, you know, making it look like there is something, some energy there that actually isn't, that has, you know, expanded the universe differently than we would predict.
Okay. Well, Willie, yes, we'll check that article out.
Yeah,
if you want to email voxpop@wamc.org with the link, we'll give it as homework to Dr. Rapson.
I'll take it.
I will look for it and do that. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. I mean, this is all part of whether the universe is expanding or not.
Right.
So what do we really know? We think we know there was a Big Bang, right?
Yes. We're pretty confident that happened. We have tons of observational and mathematical evidence that all agrees that that did happen.
But our minds, at least my mind, and maybe not yours because you're obviously brilliant, but I can't fathom something happening. I can't fathom it coming out of nothing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The Big Bang just boom.
Right,
there was
right.
nothing before it. It doesn't make sense to me, nor can I fathom a universe that is infinite. It's impossible for me to imagine that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of astronomy, is that some of this stuff is just literally beyond our imagination. There's not really any good analogies or any good ways to think about it. But what we can do is observe everything in our current universe that we are able to see, and all of the puzzle pieces point to some sort of, you know, explosion's not the best word, but some sort of force in the beginning that caused our universe to move outward, because everything we look at shows that objects are moving away from us and that the whole universe, outer space, the physical space is expanding. So what other solution do you have if you run the clock backwards other than some sort of initial trigger that pushed it outwards?
All right. I'm still not entirely convinced. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. This email from Dave at voxpop@wamc.org. Dave writes, They say the moon spins or turns, but not like the Earth. Why? And is that unique to our moon, or do some moons spin while others do not? Confounded, Dave.
Yes. So the moon and the Earth, they both rotate. They both rotate counterclockwise on their axis. But what's special about the moon is that it's tidally locked to Earth. So it's basically at just the right distance where the force of gravity has kind of locked the moon. So it has to spin at the exact same rate that it orbits around the Earth. So it's like 27 and a half days or something it takes the moon to go around. And that's the same rate that it spins on its axis. That is special to our moon because of its position, and a lot of planets, especially the gas giants, they have large moons that are tidally locked as well. Many of the closer ones are, and the moons farther out, they have, you know, all different types of spins. Some are spinning very slow, some very fast, but I don't know of any that aren't spinning at all. You know, momentum is carried through the systems continuously, so everything is spinning in one fashion or another.
I mean, does it, speaking of things that really I cannot fathom about the universe, and at some point you have to say, well, gosh, you know, the weak minds like mine would say, well, there has to be some sort of intelligent, divine plan for this, because the moon currently, at least for the next several thousand years, is the perfect size to eclipse the sun.
Yeah.
Doesn't that make you think?
I mean, it literally is just chance that we have the moon the size that it is, the position that it is, and we're lucky to kind of live in this time frame where, you know, eclipses exist. But if we didn't have that, we wouldn't even really be thinking about eclipses. So that's kind of the other side of the coin there, is we're excited about them and we're enjoying them because we can. But if we weren't able to, if we were on Mars or something, we'd never be able to see total solar eclipses.
Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. If you have an astronomy question for Dr. Valerie Rapson from SUNY Oneonta, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Mike in Rexford writes, orange false color on the web. Why does NASA predominantly use the color orange for galaxies in the false color images from the web?
So this isn't true of all pictures, but in many cases, the way that we assign these false colors is the longer the wavelength, the redder the color is depicted. So the blue doesn't actually look blue to our eyes. It's just the shortest wavelength of the set of pictures that we've taken. And in many cases, the galaxies, especially those that are farther away, they actually are redder. We are detecting longer wavelengths from them. So part of it is, you know, the way we choose the colors, but part of it is that the distant galaxies themselves are actually redshifted to the point where they physically look more orange or red than they actually should be.
And that means they're moving faster?
Yeah.
As in relation to us?
Correct. Yep. The more redshifted you are, the faster you're moving.
Why? Why is there not a uniform speed limit?
Well, they're farther away. That tells us that the expansion rate of the universe is not constant, that it's actually changing in time. So the farther away we look, we see an accelerated expansion of the universe.
And this is one of the reasons we think that there was a Big Bang?
Yeah, that's part of it. It all kind of predicts this together, you know, and the rate of which we've expanded has changed over the years. You know, it started out relatively consistent, then we saw inflation first. So we saw this burst of energy that pushed us outward. Then we moved relatively constant. And now in more recent times, the universe seems to be accelerating. And, you know, dark energy, going back to that, is kind of our answer to this. But it's an answer that still raises a lot of questions, because we don't know what dark energy is, but we can see its apparent effects, which are changing the speed at which the universe is accelerating.
But if, as Willie alluded to, there is a misunderstanding about dark energy, or it does not exist, does that mean then the universe will in fact deflate?
We don't see any evidence that that's the case. Even if dark energy itself as a physical entity or energy, whatever you want to call it, even if that doesn't exist, we still see objects moving away from us. We don't see the rate slowing, and we see very little moving towards us, and it's only the objects that are closest under our own gravitational force that are moving towards us. So we don't think that we're going to turn around and start to, you know, decrease, collapse back in on ourselves.
But it's such a huge universe. Would we notice even a small... I mean, this is over billions of years.
Sure, sure. But we're pretty good at this point at looking for all those patterns. You know, we're able to clock galaxies and see them through all different time frames at all different locations. And it all is telling us the same thing. All of our theories are pointing to this ever-expanding universe at the moment.
You know? A very confident astrophysicist. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest today from SUNY Oneonta. It's astronomy. 800-348-2551. A couple more emails here before we go back to the phones.
Sure.
This is from Rich in New Jersey. Good luck.
Could you
explain to a math-challenged non-scientist, and I'll put myself in this category, Rich, why is the square of the speed of light in this famous equation E equals mc squared? How did this number become the big factor in describing the relationship between energy and matter? Now, remember, we only have about 27 minutes, so good luck.
Well, the short answer is that's what works, right? I mean, I can write an equation down on a piece of paper, any equation I want, but the left-hand side has to equal the right-hand side of the equation if I'm putting the equal sign there. So in Einstein's relativity and his discovery of energy equals mass times the speed of light squared, we don't see a direct relationship. Well, it's a direct relationship, but it's not equivalent. Mass is not equivalent to the amount of energy. You have to multiply by the speed of light squared to have it equal the energy to have all the rest of the math work. So that's all you really need to know. We don't have to dig into the actual, like, origins of it. It's just that, you know, for all of relativity to work, and it does observationally and mathematically, you have to have the speed of light squared.
I fear that is not going to be sufficient for Rich or me. Sorry.
Well, you wanted the baby version.
All right, fair enough. Thank you. Thank you for treating me like the idiot I am. I appreciate it. All right, this is from Laura. Does Valerie have any comments or thoughts about the predicted upcoming solar storms? I thought these are going to be pretty weak.
So there was an article this morning that there was a small solar storm that was released, and we're not expecting tremendous aurora from this. If you live in the northern states like Maine or Michigan, you might be able to see a little bit on camera. But we are in solar maximum. We're seeing more sunspots, so we expect more solar flares, storms, all of that good stuff. So the one that's coming up is supposed to hit us in a day or two because it just happened. And the KP index, I think they said, is supposed to be like 5 or 6, which basically means northern states and Canada, aurora may be visible. But when we saw the tremendous displays this past year, you know, we're talking about a KP index of 8 or 9, which is, 100 to 1,000 times more powerful of a storm. So we aren't going to get to see anything from this most recent one, but I wouldn't be surprised if later this year or in the next couple of years, we see a few more great storms.
Wasn't that awesome?
It was amazing.
Yeah.
I had never really seen it so directly before. You know, Bob goes on these wonderful trips, so he sees it all the time.
He's probably there now.
Yeah, I hadn't had the chance to like actually experience it and to just watch the red lights dance above my house that night was just the coolest thing.
Yeah, I mean, the one I saw maybe 40 years ago
had
the curtain-like ribbon waving in the sky.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Right, right.
But I think that maybe where I live, if I were able to stay out longer and the ambient light was less, that might happen a little more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we saw plenty of colors, green and red.
Yeah, yeah.
Although, interestingly, part of my family could see... What's the tougher color to see? The green or red?
The green, usually.
Yeah. I could see the green.
Mm-hmm.
My son could see the green. Several others in my family could not. It was very
interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it must be something about how your eyes have adapted.
Indeed. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. Let's grab a call here from Lawrence in Western Massachusetts. Lawrence, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I had a comment about the confounding dilemma of getting something from nothing. And I would say that, tautologically speaking, if you define nothing as the absolute absence of anything, then you can't get something from nothing. Therefore, everything that's here has always been here. And that although it seems evident that there was a Big Bang, it's probably an oscillating universe where it expands and contracts, of course, over, you know, cosmic eons. And so that's my comment.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we talk about this, you know, the universe appearing from nothing, but you are right. You know, it's really believed that the energy had to be there, right? You can't just create it out of absolutely nothing. So the energy was there in a very compact way that, you know, quantum mechanically we still can't yet explain, but something triggered it to be pushed outward, to disperse, to cool off. And it's really extremely difficult for us to dig deeper into those initial moments, but that's where things like gravitational waves might finally help us answer those questions, because we'll never be able to see past that cosmic microwave background wall with our telescopes. But the gravitational waves, they go much further back. And if we can check on those vibrations, you know, I don't know, potentially days, years, you know, after the Big Bang, then we can, you know, really start to understand what the earliest portion of the universe was. And maybe that'll give us some clues as to what actually happened.
And they travel at the speed of light?
Yes, they do.
Lawrence, you want to follow up?
No, I would say the concept of everything having always been here is almost equally confounding.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree,
really,
man.
Wrap my head around that either. But anyway, that was just an
observation. Thanks a lot.
Observation.
Appreciate the call very much. Can gravity waves, not, is it gravitational waves or gravity waves? Different.
Gravitational.
Gravitational waves. Can they be modulated with information?
That's a good question. I don't know all those details.
That would be something.
I don't think so. Right. That's, now we're getting back into our aliens discussion. Maybe the aliens are embedding their messages into gravitational waves.
No,
I think the question would be, how do we pull it out? You know,
yeah.
We're really, I doubt it. We're really just seeing, you know, fluctuations in literal space time. So I think the answer is no, but, you know, maybe a gravitational wave scientist knows better than
Fair enough.
Do.
Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. It's astronomy. Back to the phones and the emails in a moment. Taters, there's Junior Brown here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. It's astronomy. And, okay, an email or two, and then we'll go back to the phones.
Sure.
This is from Mark in Middletown. Oh, are the words cosmos and universe synonyms? Just trying to clarify.
Yeah, I don't remember of the exact origin of cosmos, but we usually think about it pretty much the same. You know, when I talk about the universe or the cosmos, I use them interchangeably. The root of those words might be slightly different technically, but, you know, cosmology is just the study of the evolution of the
right.
universe. So makes sense to
Carl
me.
Carl Sagan liked to use cosmos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you ever meet him?
It sounds fancier than universe. No, I never had the chance to meet him.
He seemed
it
like
would have been awesome, though.
Might have been just a little pompous at times, yeah? Or my
yeah, but he, I love that he was so pro public outreach and science communication.
Oh yeah, for sure.
You know, like that's what I love about some of these more popularized scientists is that they actually care to share the information with everybody, and they want to make sure that everybody is excited about all these cool things that are happening, not just the scientists.
That's what I love about having you on this program, because you know about all this stuff in much deeper detail than we mere mortals, but you're making it so that we can understand a little bit.
That's the goal. You know, I've had a lot of practice, and I don't sit here and try and be an expert on everything, because I definitely am not. But I've had a ton of practice taking these more complicated concepts and trying to distill them down in a way that a child in a planetarium show or an average person calling in would be able to learn a little bit of something and then leave curious to go learn some more on their own. That's the ultimate goal.
It's so great, because ultimately it The ultimate answer of all of this, if we could solve every question, is why are we here?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's
right.
What it's all about.
That's what we want to know.
Let's go to Hillsdale and Alan. Alan, you're on.
Hello. I have a question about the other night, Tuesday night, mm-hmm. I believe. I was happened to be looking up at the sky, and my son pointed out that there is a line of lights moving from west to east.
Yes.
And they were at arm's length, they were three fingers wide.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably, I don't know, maybe 10 to 20 lights.
Ah, I know. What time? It was this about 6:15, 6:50 or so in that?
Yeah, it could have been, yes.
I think
and
you and Ray
right
saw
near
the same
Orion.
Thing.
It was headed towards Orion's belt.
Yeah, man.
And then it just disappeared.
Well, I'm not the expert, so I'll let Valerie tell you what it was.
Yeah, yeah. Ray knows, though. You definitely saw some Starlink satellites. So
yep.
These are the satellites that we've been launching for the giant internet connections across the world. And they launch in small batches, so, you know, 10 to 30 satellites at once. And as they disperse across the sky, they start out in a straight line, and they'll move across your sky. And then as nights go by, they'll spread out and ultimately end up in whatever location they're planned for.
So
okay, I kind of assumed that that's what it was, but mm-hmm. I just
yeah.
But you guys are on there, so
right.
I'd ask.
Thanks
no,
a
no.
lot, Alan. Appreciate it very much. I'll tell you what. When I saw these, I was telling you before the show,
mm-hmm.
2 days ago, it was 10 degrees below zero, and I went out to warm the car up. And I'm out in my slippers and no coat and
right.
standing there, and all of a sudden, there are 21,
yeah.
and I counted them,
mm-hmm.
Starlinks. They were very close together,
yep.
as Alan mentioned. And so I watched them for too long because my beard froze and everything else. But as they were going as a string of pearls across
yep.
the sky toward the, I want to say southeast, or mm-hmm. to the east anyway,
yeah.
one of them got really bright.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume they're tumbling at the same time?
Yeah, they tend to be rotating, and you're probably catching the solar panel just tipping the right way to be able to reflect some light back from the ground. We see this with the space station all the time because the solar panels are so big. As it rotates, if it redirects the light, we'll call it an iridium flare because it was the iridium satellites that, you know, first did this. But all the satellites with large solar panels will have those flashes.
Are the iridium still up there?
They might be.
I call anytime
I
we see that, I say,
yeah.
oh, it's an iridium sat, but I don't even
yeah,
know.
Yeah, it's usually not anymore. I'm sure many of them are down now, but I don't know for sure.
You know, we don't get out much. My wife and I watch satellites all the time.
yeah.
And so there's a prime time, and
mm-hmm.
maybe you can answer this for me. Is it like an hour after sundown when it's prime time?
Yeah.
When is the best time to
yeah.
see satellites?
Usually, like, you know, right after sunset or before sunrise, because you're still getting a little bit of sunlight hitting in the upper atmosphere there, so you're catching them at a little bit brighter of a time because the sun is still there to reflect some scattered light back to Earth.
Very
so
interesting.
You see them more frequently then. Plus, we're just outside more frequently then, so you get more reports, right? There's more of us looking for satellites at 6:15 than there is at 3 in the morning.
Correct.
So.
And, you know, you're very good, and you're treating these satellite questions with real and amiable nature, and
mm-hmm.
I would assume most astronomers hate satellites.
Yeah, I mean, they do get in the way, and they cause a lot of people to ask about, you know, UFOs and stuff. But most of the time when people see strange things in the sky, it's either a satellite, because there's so many nowadays, or they mistake one of the planets. You know,
yeah.
we talked about the planet parade, and they're just all up there in a straight line. So people are asking me, oh, what's that dot in the south? And,
yeah.
you know, they're just curious about
Jupiter's
it.
Gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And Venus has been so bright, and it's just wonderful.
Yeah.
Let's go to Shelburne, Mass., and it's Lillian's turn. Hello, Lillian.
It's Lynn. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, after the Big Bang, all these rocks, I guess, mm-hmm. are going through this wilderness up there, and they're just shooting out. How did they start spinning? I mean, what's it to get them, you know, they're just shooting out straight. What? I don't know.
Yeah, so the whole process is a bit more complicated. From the Big Bang, we didn't initially have, you know, rocks and stars and larger objects. But if you think about today's time frame, when all the objects are in the current universe, everything is moving. And all it takes is one little bump or collision with another object to start something rotating. And in space, there's no friction. You know, if you start to spin something atop on a table, there's friction between the table and the top, and ultimately it's going to slow down. The air and the table will stop it. But in space, there's essentially no friction.
There has
so you
to be
start
some, right?
something, well, a very small amount, you know, with the particles, the low
quantum
density that
fizz.
Are there. Maybe, but generally speaking, that low friction allows things to just spin forever. Momentum will always be conserved and you'll keep spinning forever. So the short answer to your question is, you know, things are going to interact gravitationally or they're physically going to collide. And once something starts spinning, it's never going to stop unless it hits another object.
Okay. Well, Lillian, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. Dr. Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. What do you prefer, physics or astronomy?
Well, I like astrophysics. Can we put it together?
Sure. Yeah. Why not?
I think I sound more fancy if I'm an astrophysicist.
Totally. Let's go to Jackson, New Jersey. Jeff, go ahead.
Good afternoon, and thanks.
You bet.
I just wanted to comment about the C squared question about E equals MC squared. And Bucky Fuller didn't like the word squared. So he defined second powering to be the ratio of the surface area to the radius of an expanding sphere.
Okay.
And why that makes sense is because if you double the radius, then it's got four times as much area. Mm-hmm. Or if you triple the radius, you got nine times as much area. So that does square. I mean, it does fit in with how we think of the second powering.
Yeah.
So my question is, if you light a match, which I guess is changing matter to energy, my question is, what direction does the light go?
Well, the light is going to disperse out in all directions, essentially. If you are
directionally outward.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And that's if you were to look at a match, you could stand in any location as long as the match is within eyesight and see it. If something isn't blocking, it's because the light is dispersing in all directions.
Uh-huh. Jeff.
So same as with a light bulb. So I'm thinking, maybe the connection is when you change matter to energy, it goes omnidirectionally outward. That's the C squared. That's according to Bucky's definition. That's the light going out in all directions. That's C squared, seems like.
Well, what do you think, Val?
I mean, the relationships are definitely the same, you know, because area is proportional to the radius squared. You see those types of relationships. I don't know that it's directly related to the fact that things are moving omnidirectionally, but light does have that property that it, you know, an object that's emitting light will spread out in all directions.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it. Always great to hear from New Jersey. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. Do you ever, you know, you have to deal with kids, freshmen often, and then you have to deal with radio hosts and regular people. Does it ever drive you nuts when we just can't grasp something?
No, it doesn't bother me one bit. I take it as a personal challenge to try and continue to re-explain or think of another way to do it so that everybody can understand. Huh. You know, like that's the fun part of my job is I could stand in front of a room and regurgitate the textbook and just expect you to learn, but that's no fun for me or for you. The goal and the challenge is to, you know, how can I do this in a fun way that you're going to care, you're going to be excited, and you're actually going to remember something. And it's different depending on who you're speaking to. My science majors, I teach very differently than the kids in the planetarium because you're at different levels, and that's totally okay. But that's the fun part of my job is how do I explain it to everybody?
By the way, how is the planetarium?
Oh, it's doing well. We're going to have our first show this Friday night, and then we're going to do every other Friday and then every Saturday starting in February. So we're getting going on that, and I have a new intern. I'm very excited. He starts next week, so he'll
he's going to be washing
shows.
Your car and plugging everything in.
Yeah, right? No, he's going to be presenting planetarium shows and eventually designing some new content for the planetarium.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Mike in Oak Hill. Mike, you're on.
Hey, how's it going? I tuned in a little late, so I hope the question hasn't been asked already, but it's about inflation.
Yeah.
And I'm all good. It all makes sense. The constant makes sense. And then except for the part at the beginning of the universe where it completely, you know, it defies that speed limit and expands at this ridiculous rate. So I'm just trying to understand that. Maybe you can dumb it down for me a little bit. I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't think anybody truly understands what exactly is inflation and how it came about. But we do see the universe itself, the space between the galaxies and whatnot, it did expand faster than the speed of light. So there's the limit that, you know, light and objects cannot move faster than the speed of light. But there is nothing in our theories that says that space can't expand faster than the speed of light. So that seems to have happened, and we don't have a full enough explanation to tell you exactly why, you know, what caused that to happen. That's still something that we're trying to figure out.
Got it. Thank you. That answers my question.
Welcome, Mike, thanks a lot. This email from Darlene, who says, I will preface this by saying that my late husband was a minister. He always felt it was easy to reconcile the biblical story of the creation of the universe and the Big Bang Theory. God snapped his finger, enjoying the show, and that's from Darlene in Egremont.
Mm, yeah, that's a great way to think about it.
And then another person said, this is Gracie in Sheffield, it wasn't something out of nothing. God was there. He or she spoke, and the power in his voice created the Big Bang. Energy became matter, sort of like an atomic bomb backwards.
Mm, interesting, yeah. You know, there's a lot of colleagues that I have that have very deeply religious beliefs, and, you know, it's really interesting to talk to them to see how they take their personal beliefs and kind of meld it with the science.
Reconcile it with science.
Yeah, and I always like to say, you know, we're not out here as scientists trying to disprove anything or prove anybody wrong. We're just trying to take what we observe and come up with some explanations that make it make sense while keeping whatever faith we choose to have as well.
And the Vatican has an astronomer and has for a long time, and thankfully they're not burning them at the stake anymore, so it's working out pretty well.
Yes.
Let's go to Fred in Albany. Fred, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
It's very funny because that was my question as well. I just wanted to know what God fits, how God fits into this whole picture of the Big Bang and the cosmos in the scientific realm. Thank you.
I got to say, Fred, you know, Valerie's brilliant, but I'm not sure she's going to be able to answer that one. But give it a shot.
I don't have the answers here, but, you know, everybody has different beliefs, different levels of beliefs of where God plays a role in their life and in the universe as a whole. And there's nothing to say that they can't coexist, in my mind. I think they very much can. And there are many things that we can't explain, and maybe someday we will be able to, and maybe we can't. And faith can kind of fill those holes temporarily until we're able to come up with, you know, something more.
You know, just sort of anecdotal information of your colleagues throughout the world, all those that you know, and you have a network of astrophysicists, I'm sure, that you contact via email and everything.
Yeah.
What percentage are religious or is religious?
I would say at least 50%.
Really?
Maybe more than you would think. Yeah, they hold some sort of religious beliefs at different levels. You know?
I mean, if you look at all the wonders of the universe, you have to sort of say, wow, I can't believe
it,
this.
It is. You know, it's hard to imagine how all of this beauty and wonder came about, you know, and it would be great if there was just some sort of God that put it there. And, you know, we have a purpose to study it and explore it and enjoy it.
Besides God, what is your biggest mystery in what you do in astrophysics? Mm. What is that one thing that you're like, oh, wow, how the heck does that work?
it's really hard to pick the biggest mystery. Like, as we go through the generations, you know, we look back and we're like, oh, that was so obvious. Why didn't we know the answer to that? So there's so many mysteries we have today, like dark matter, dark energy, life in the universe, that, you know, I bet 100 years from now, we're going to look back and laugh at ourselves and be like, how did we not see this tremendously obvious answer? So I don't know that I have one deep question. I mean, I want to know if we are alone in the universe. That's the question that I really want answered personally.
Me too.
But I think a lot of people would say, you know, figuring out this, you know, evolution of the universe, what is this dark matter and dark energy? That seems to be kind of the top thing that everyone is trying to figure out. Mm. And there's so many different ways to go about it with theory and observation. And so many scientists are working on, you know, what is this stuff? Because it's 96% of the universe, and we can't explain it. We know that something has to be there, but we have no idea what it is. So that, you know, collectively with amongst all astronomers, they'd probably agree that that's one of the biggest mysteries.
You know, the life in the universe thing, and we only have a minute left, but it's been, 65 years since they've been looking, since SETI has really been a thing.
Right.
And we don't have signal. We had a wow signal in the late 70s, but where are they?
Right,
Fermi said it, right?
I know. And the wow signal was actually like recently disproven, like with really strong confidence that it's just hydrogen from some objects. But yeah, I mean, I think we all thought we'd be a little bit further along in the hunt for alien life at this point. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe they're just not communicating in the same way that we expect.
I mean,
you
isn't
know?
It clear that radio waves aren't going to work? Wouldn't we pick something up by now?
We would have thought, but, you know, maybe they are farther away, or maybe they just don't care. right? That's the other thing is we care. We want to know what's out there, but we have no idea if another species even wants to know. I mean, dinosaurs were on this earth for how long, and they weren't sending radio signals into space. So we don't know their level of intelligence, their desire to communicate. There's so many more things that play a role in this idea of searching for life.
Do you think the aliens were in contact with the dinosaurs? All right, listen.
Maybe. I don't know. That's a whole other show.
That's a different show. Hey, Valerie Rapson, if people want to find out more about the planetarium shows, et cetera, at SUNY Oneonta, how do they do it?
Yes, check out our website, SUNY Oneonta Planetarium. Check out Science Discovery Center's social media pages.
Beautiful, and thank you for being here. We'll see you next month.
Thank you. Sounds great.
Support comes from the Linda, WAMC's Performing Arts Studio, presenting Sound at Vision, Music at the Movies, presenting Watts Stacks, the 1975 documentary on the concert commemorating the anniversary of the Watts riots, February 4th, thelinda.org. Don't forget the lockbox is open, folks, WAMC.org. Every dollar we raise now counts on day one of the February fund drive, begins February 3rd. That's a Monday at 6 a.m. WAMC.org to make your pledge. Doesn't have to be $1 million. Doesn't even have to be $100. Doesn't even have to be $10. Throw a buck in the kitty. 800-348-255. Almost gave the fund drive number because I was doing that earlier today. All right, I'm just going to shut up now. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phone screened by Susie Chekai. Tomorrow it's Food Friday and time for another one of our baking sessions with Chef Gail Sokol. We'll see you tomorrow at 2.